The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So when we start mindfulness practice, the usual instructions, especially the instructions that are offered here, tend to encourage us to stabilize our attention on a single experience. Just to kind of get familiar with what it feels like to be aware, and to also, having that kind of stabilizing experience, usually we offer the breath or sometimes hearing as a kind of a place to anchor the attention, to help to settle and stabilize the mind. And that helps to, when you're a beginner, it helps you to begin to recognize what actually it is to be mindful, to be aware. You start paying attention, you start beginning to recognize what it means to be aware of an experience in the present moment. And so that's one of the purposes. Another purpose is that because you have chosen something to be aware of, it makes it pretty clear when you forget to pay attention to that thing. So your mind drifts off into thinking, and part of the time we actually kind of begin to recognize, my mind is wandering off into thought, and we recognize that because we recognize I'm not paying attention to the breathing. So this is kind of where we begin, and some of the benefits for cultivating mindfulness with the stability on a single object. And often I think what happens is that we get kind of stuck there in a way. We tend to think that's what we're supposed to do. But actually mindfulness practice begins to open to a broader range of experience. And as we do get more familiar with what it means to be mindful, what it means to be aware, we can broaden our repertoire, so to say. You know, we can be aware of more experiences. And the next instruction is, as I was saying in the guided meditation, you know, if there's an experience that's kind of strong, that pulls your attention away from the breath, there's no need to have any kind of sense of conflict or say, oh, the breath is more important, I'm supposed to stay with the breath. You know, a motorcycle is going by, and you've been paying attention to the breath, and suddenly, you know, it's like the attention is already paying attention to the motorcycle because it's so loud going by. There doesn't need to be a problem with that. There doesn't need to be the sense that, oh, motorcycle is not what I'm supposed to be paying attention to. Can I bring my attention back to the breathing? There is a practice like that. It's called concentration practice. But with mindfulness practice, our cultivation of mindfulness, we over time learn that we can begin to be aware and mindful of all of our experience. And so with time, we get more familiar with what it means for that mindfulness to begin to be able to connect with other experience. So we start with the breath, and then we begin to notice we can be aware of sounds, we can be attentive to sounds and other body sensations, sensations of coolness or heat, sensations of pressure, tension, vibration. So other body sensations we can be aware of. Or we might then also start to be aware that we can recognize and be aware of emotions and even thoughts, that we can be mindful while thinking. We can expand our sense of what is possible to be aware of. So ultimately, mindfulness allows any experience to be known. And over time, we start to be able to just be attentive to what the mind is naturally gravitating towards, what the mind is naturally paying attention to. And this begins actually to allow us to begin to bring this mindfulness practice into our daily lives. If we have this idea that breathing is where it's at, then while you're engaged in a conversation at work, it may or may not be so easy to practice that type of meditation, that type of connection with experience. But as we start to recognize we can be attentive to many experiences, we realize, oh, I can pay attention while I'm speaking. I can know what I'm saying. I can also kind of still be attentive to how my body is impacted by what I'm saying and what I'm listening to. And so we start to see that mindfulness can be much more supportive for us in our daily lives. And as we are mindful in our daily lives, we do also start to see that the support of mindfulness supports that lessening of reactivity, a lessening of aversion and greed in our minds, that the mindfulness kind of can bring along with it a little bit of balance, a little bit of, sometimes a little bit of sense of a perspective on the situation that gives us a little bit of ease or some peacefulness that can carry into our lives. And we also get to learn about our minds, especially in daily life. You know, in daily life, our minds are doing all kinds of things and leading us into all kinds of traps and difficulties based a lot on our habits and patterns of mind. And so when we're mindful, we start to see how those patterns work, how those patterns unfold. And as the mind begins to recognize, as the mindfulness can take in those patterns, it starts to see which ones are not so helpful and which ones support us. So the mind can start to make choice. The mindfulness allows us to make skillful choices. So this direction of our practice is to cultivate this ability for us to be aware of whatever is happening in our experience. Kind of noticing what's obvious in our experience as a way into this, just recognizing in a moment what's the clearest thing, what's the thing that the mind is kind of naturally gravitating to at this point. So the stability of the meditation at that point comes not from being stable on a single experience like the breathing, but that the mindfulness itself gets stable. The mindfulness becomes more continuous, and then we have the possibility of entering into a kind of a flow of our experience, just the connection to just the changing stream of seeing, smelling, hearing, tasting, touching, and thoughts, emotions, moods going through our minds. So we can enter into this river of experience and be mindful. So this awareness, so this is kind of the direction of mindfulness practice, to move towards meeting all of our experience. And yet, just simply meeting our experience isn't quite enough to really understand our minds and to let go of some of the reactivity and habits of mind. We have so many habits in our mind that kind of operate often on autopilot below the level of our conscious awareness. And so if we just focus on what's obvious in our experience, what's happening moment to moment, sometimes what's obvious to us may be kind of, it's kind of like there's some orientation of our minds that we may not be aware of, some view or some filter, some perspective that we carry around that we may not be very aware of, and that perspective or that view, that kind of filter, chooses for us what is obvious in our experience. I'll give you an example of this, and I think this will be familiar to you. I think that you'll recognize this kind of experience. So if you have a situation where you're talking to somebody and it's a kind of a charged conversation, and you get reactive, you get upset, you get angry in that conversation, you may find that as you leave that situation, that your mind is kind of in the space of that reactivity, in the space of that anger. And that that filter or perspective of anger then kind of screens your environment, screens what comes into your awareness, particularly choosing for those things that you're annoyed about. Or it may even color what's happening out there to make you feel annoyed about anything. I remember on one retreat, I've told this story before, so some of you may have heard this. I experienced quite a bit of aversion in walking meditation on a number of my retreats. And I began to notice that as that aversion came up, that it was like whatever the mind landed on, whatever experience the mind touched on, I didn't like it. So it was as if that aversive quality that came from, often it came because in this particular retreat center, it was winter and it was cold and we were all crammed into these little tiny rooms and, you know, there's a bunch of people. We were all walking really close to each other and I like a lot of space. So, you know, this brought up the aversion. So that was kind of the source, and I knew that the aversion came from the physical proximity with the other people. But, you know, I'm doing the walking meditation, and I see somebody's shoes down at the other end, and it's like, I hated those shoes. What are those shoes doing there? You know. So this is an example of the way our mind filters things. You know, that something, some perspective or some view that we have can choose essentially how we're seeing, how we're perceiving things. And so, you know, the filters and views, actually, this kind of sense of perspective or a sense that, you know, there's some kind of veil or something coloring our experience. This kind of thing actually happens to us a lot. We're just not so aware of it. You know, if you put on a pair of glasses, a sunglasses, you know, if I had some sunglasses and I put them on, if I wore them for a while, it would almost be like that I would forget. You know, it would be like I'd just get used to what it was like looking through those sunglasses. Things would still be dark, you know, colored by those glasses, the grayness of the glasses. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily be noticing that grayness all the time. And this is kind of what happens with our minds. If we have familiar patterns of perspectives that we're used to seeing our experience through, sometimes we just don't notice them because they're so familiar to us. So in the way that our minds work, if we have a perspective such as a perspective of annoyance or irritation, and we're not aware of it particularly, just kind of it's in the background, and we're responding and reacting and noticing things in our environment from that perspective, essentially what's happening is that we're reinforcing that perspective. So we need a way, or it's helpful to have a way to begin to uncover some of these hidden perspectives, hidden filters, these views, these opinions, these filters that we live with, views that we see the world through but might not be particularly aware of in a moment. So this is about starting to get interested in how we are observing things. So in the typical instructions about mindfulness, the beginning instructions are about noticing what is happening. What are you noticing in your experience? You're noticing pressure or vibration or tension or tightness or sound or sight or an emotion. You're noticing whatever's happening in your experience. The next kind of step in our experience is to begin to see how are we relating to what we are noticing. We may be seeing that experience, that what is happening, through some kind of a filter. And so to kind of just begin to check in, is there some experience, some filter operating? You know, in mindfulness practice, this mindfulness practice I describe where we are just opening to whatever is happening in the flow of our experience, not necessarily focusing on just the breathing. In this practice of seeing this flow of experience going through, it really does not matter what you're paying attention to. It does not matter. There's no hierarchy of better experience on which you can cultivate mindfulness. They're equal opportunity objects, equal opportunity experience with respect to cultivating mindfulness. It doesn't matter. What is very important, though, in terms of cultivating the kind of mindfulness that will support us in freeing our hearts from constriction, from suffering, from pain, from defensiveness, is how we are paying attention. That's the key towards freedom, is that how the mind is paying attention. So this is essentially the realm of what our relationship to our experience is. Not just in meditation, but in our daily lives. And what I'd like to actually propose is that the suffering of our lives, the distress, the dissatisfaction, the struggle, comes in our relationship to our experience. And so keeping an eye on how we're relating to experience is very useful, because this is essentially the place where our reactivity is born. So one of my teachers, the Burmese teacher that I will be teaching his style on Saturday, Saito Utejaniya, he has a very simple technique for beginning to check into this relationship to our experience. It's very simple. He just simply says, ask yourself, what's your relationship to the experience? You could use a question, you know, what's my relationship to this experience? It can be that simple, actually. And just to put that question into the mind. Now, this use of questions in exploring our experience is something we need to do kind of carefully, in a way, because often questions, if we put a question into our mind in a way of thinking about it, you know, what is my relationship to this experience? Sometimes that can prompt us to start thinking about, well, what is my relationship to this experience? Do I like it? Do I not like it? Or maybe I'm afraid of it? Or, you know, so we can start kind of hypothesizing through thought. And that's not the point of this question. The point of this question is kind of to just drop the question into your experience and then see what happens. It's kind of like, I sometimes like to say, I think of it like I'm ringing a doorbell. That question is like ringing a doorbell. And then you wait and see what answers the door. So that you're not looking for anything in particular. You're just opening to, is there something here? Is there some kind of relationship that I haven't actually quite tuned into? You know, sometimes this is obvious to us when we take the time to check in. It's like, What is my relationship to this experience? And my teacher in Burma shortens that to what's my attitude? This attitude is his term for our relationship to experience. So how am I relating to experience? Or what's the how of my experience? Or what's my attitude? All of these questions could serve. So in asking that question, just opening to what's here. Now, sometimes, as I said, it can be really obvious. You know, you're sitting there in meditation and you're paying attention to an itch on your nose. And, you know, you're focused right on that itch. And it's like, yep, I'm going to be a good meditator. I'm not going to move. I'm not going to scratch that itch. And I'm just going to focus on that itch. If you stop and ask yourself, what's your relationship to that experience? It may be glaringly obvious. I don't like this. This is not fun. I'm not enjoying this. So it may not have been so clear that this was kind of the attitude in our mind before you checked. But in the checking of the attitude, sometimes it can be really obvious. Just, oh yeah, I don't like this. So in this recognizing or asking this question of what's my attitude, sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not so obvious, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. In the recognizing of what the attitude is, the instruction at that point is to allow that to be included in what we're paying attention to. Essentially what happens is, it's kind of like we have been looking through this filter. So in this example of the itchy nose, you know, we've been looking through this filter of seeing the experience through this filter of not liking. And it's kind of like before we were looking through the lenses of not liking. And the whole, perhaps even the whole reason for paying attention with that focused mindfulness was in order that that itch would go away, or in order that we could just burrow in so that we didn't have to not like it. So there can be that kind of focus when there's an aversion. Sometimes we can just really focus in and ignore that aversion. But in a way, that's cultivating that aversion itself, to act on that aversion in that way. So in this seeing of that aversion, what's kind of like, if I think about those glasses, is the glasses, the sunglasses analogy, what's kind of like is that we have the possibility of taking off the sunglasses and looking at them instead of looking through them. So it shifts our perspective on that phenomenon of that ill will. I've been talking about hindrances this week with the Daily Life Practice Retreat. And one of the things I said on Monday night when I talked about the hindrances is that when we turn our attention to the hindrances, when we recognize the hindrances in our experience and turn our attention towards them, they're no longer functioning as hindrances. They're no longer in the way of our practice. They are our practice. And it's similar with this attitude. When we turn and recognize this attitude and can look at it instead of through it, it's no longer operating in that way where it's kind of like, you know, the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz, you know, pulling all these levers and creating this amazing phenomenon up there. And then, you know, Toto goes over and pulls the curtain back. It's like, oh, it's just the guy behind the curtain. It's kind of that kind of movement that when we see, oh, there's just anger happening here and we're not looking through it, it doesn't have the same power. You know, when we're not so aware of our greed or aversion or delusion, it has this power over us in a way. We act out of it without even being aware that we're acting out of it. And so this kind of revealing it, looking at it instead of through it, it no longer quite has that capacity to influence our decisions or our actions as it did when we were just looking through it, when the perspective was there and we were unaware of it, when that view or filter was there and we were unaware of it. Now, sometimes in this movement of checking the attitude and recognizing, oh yeah, I don't like this, or I like this, or whatever the perspective is. Sometimes we can recognize that perspective and not particularly be able to take off the glasses and look at them, but we can, it's like, Yeah, I know I really don't like this. And boy, yeah, I really don't like this. I mean, that's still the perspective. We're still looking at it. But at least we know we are looking at it from that perspective. So that's a kind of shift that can happen also. It's not quite as... we can tell. It's kind of like we're still a little bit caught by that phenomenon of that ill will. Where when we can take the glasses off and we can look at the ill will directly without any resistance, there's a feeling of, oh, there's just ill will happening. It doesn't particularly feel like a problem. So the movement in noticing that there is some kind of perspective or attitude going on is to include that, to turn towards that experience, to include that, to turn towards what does it feel like to be feeling ill will. So this tool of checking the attitude is a powerful way to uncover hidden hindrances, hidden agendas, hidden views, hidden attitudes, hidden beliefs even. Now when we turn to do this, when we turn to use this tool, this technique, check the attitude, one of several things can happen, and I'll just go through this briefly, to some of the things you might notice. The first thing you might notice in checking the attitude, you know, so you're paying attention to your experience, and you know the instructions are just from time to time to check in to the attitude. It's not something you want to do like every 2 seconds. If you start doing it, oh, what's my attitude? What's my attitude? What's my attitude? It just gets way too busy. So you might want to check your attitude in your meditation practice. You might want to check your attitude, oh, I don't know, you know, 4 or 5 times during a 40-minute sitting, you know, every 10 minutes or so, check into your attitude. And in a little while, I'll give you some suggestions about some places where, or times when are particularly helpful to check the attitude. So from time to time, just checking in, what's my attitude? What's my relationship to my experience? And in that checking in, sometimes you might notice there's not particularly, you don't notice anything. You know, there's nothing obvious going on. Sometimes this might happen because sometimes our attitudes are kind of subtle. You know, as I said, sometimes they can really be hidden from us. These views, these beliefs can kind of be hidden from us. So they might just be a little more subtle than we can quite touch into at the moment. So if there's no particular obvious attitude, another reason why sometimes the attitude might not be obvious is because the mind might be relatively calm or balanced. You know, it might just be, oh, you know, there's no particular problem here. That itself is what we can call right attitude. And I'll talk about that in just a moment. So you might not see anything much in particular. And if that's what happens, don't go trying to dig. Don't go trying to find out, well, what is my attitude? There's got to be something here. So that's way too busy again. If there's nothing obvious, if nothing strikes you immediately, then just let it go and go back to just noticing what you're aware of, just what is happening. Go back to that, just paying attention to the what of your experience and let go of the how for now. And check in again in another few minutes. After a little while, there may be something clear that comes up. So that might be one thing that happens. I'll give you an example of that particular thing in my experience. There was one point where I was looking at a phenomena that was a kind of a vigilance of mind. It was kind of like when the mind got calm, I was noticing that the mind would sometimes slip into depression. And so I noticed that the mind was pretty calm, and I noticed a kind of vigilance come up about that calmness, as if it's kind of like saying, okay, is that depression going to follow this calm? So I was noticing that vigilance, and noticing that vigilance, I checked in. You know, I was suspicious. I thought, you know, this could be motivated by some unskillful attitude. But I checked in, and I didn't particularly see any unskillful attitude. In fact, it seemed kind of helpful to be vigilant there. So I just went on with noticing my experience, and within a few minutes, my mind got really tired. And that tiredness was a clue. And I checked my attitude again. And I saw that vigilance had a little bit of force to it. It was pushing a little too hard to try to find, is this calm going to turn into depression? accompanied by a little bit of fear of depression perhaps arising. So after a couple of minutes of just continuing with the observation, the attitude became clear. You know, so I didn't have to dig. I didn't have to look or try to find it. I just kept noticing. And after a few minutes, that attitude was obvious to me. So in the checking in to the attitude, if there is an attitude, there'll be one of four basic flavors to the attitude of your mind. Three of them you'll recognize right away. One flavor is along the lines of wanting something to happen, wanting something to have something. So basically the flavor of greed. Then there's the attitude of not wanting something, wanting to get rid of something, wanting to push something away. The attitude of aversion. Then there may be the attitude of confusion, unclarity, uncertainty. And the attitude of delusion. So those are the kind of three basic unhelpful patterns that underlie a lot of our that are connected with some of our habits, our patterns, our filters, the habitual ways that we engage that we're not so cognizant of at times. So greed, aversion, delusion. You know, these manifest in many ways. You may notice an attitude of frustration. That's kind of an aversive attitude. You may notice an attitude of excitement, kind of reaching out with excitement. That's kind of a greedy attitude. So, you know, you don't have to label it as greed, aversion, or delusion. I'm just kind of covering the terrain here. Because all of our unskillful, unhelpful mind states have these three states as a foundation. And I'll talk a little bit more about them. And then so the fourth attitude that we might come across is what we could call right attitude or balance of mind. This is an attitude in which the mind is at ease with whatever's happening in experience. No particular problem with whatever's happening in experience. So this is the attitude essentially that if we have this attitude of mind, this is when the mindfulness becomes powerful. And we can have right attitude about wrong attitude. So we can see, we can notice that we're paying attention to something, and then we check in. Oh, what's my attitude? Oh, I see, I don't like that. And then we can notice there's not liking. So then the not liking becomes the what is happening, and we check in, what's my attitude about not liking? Oh, that seems okay, I can be with not liking. Or there may be resistance. So then there's yet another attitude. And so we kind of, this practice of checking the attitude can kind of uncover layers of filters, kind of layers of veils that we have in front of our experience. And at some point we may come back to, oh, I can be with that. There's frustration. Okay, I can be with frustration. Or there's sadness. Oh, I can be with sadness. And so we can be with something challenging with this balance of mind. So this may take the form of something like ease or peace, or clarity, interest, curiosity. Any of those kinds of states may be clear to you when you check in. What's my attitude? Oh, I'm really interested in this. This is very interesting. Or, I feel pretty peaceful about this. This is in the terrain of right attitude. Let's see. I'm taking more time with this than I expected, so I think what I'll say is I'll just talk a little bit about each of the three kinds of difficult attitudes, the three kinds of what we might call wrong attitude. When it's operating in the back of our mind and it's not seen, it's not helpful for us. But when it comes into our awareness and we can see it, it's not a problem for us. So with each of these, especially with greed and aversion, there's kind of an obvious form and a more subtle form. So the obvious form of greed is the kind of like, this is right, this feels really good, I want more of this, this is the way it's supposed to be, you know, that kind of attitude. Sometimes it can be really clear. It's like we're sitting in meditation and the breath feels really smooth and clear. It's like, well, I'll check in the attitude. Oh yeah, I like this. I want this to keep going. This is, I finally figured it out. You know, that can be kind of clear, that there's that kind of wanting this to continue, some kind of agenda around that. Then there's more subtle wanting. Perhaps, you know, the ones that I've noticed in my own experience that are a little more subtle, things like expectation. You know, kind of like just a subtle leaning into the experience of, oh, is something going to happen here? You know, just a little bit of, so it's not a major kind of wanting. It's kind of almost a little bit of over interest. It's like, oh yeah, this is really interesting. A little bit of greed in there. So there can be some subtlety to these attitudes. Sometimes I've even seen something like a wanting to understand or a wanting to know that just has a little bit of a skew to it. It has some clinging. It's not okay to just be with things as they are. It's like there's something happening. It's not quite clear in my mind what it is. There's just like, oh, what is that? I need to know. And that has a little bit of greed to it. So they can be both obvious and subtle. And likewise with the aversion, there can be obvious, and at least in my experience, aversion is my hindrance of choice. You know, that's my favorite hindrance, the one that operates most frequently in my mind. So, you know, that one in my experience, in particular, can be very, very obvious. You know, for others, you know, greed may be the most obvious, and that would be the kind of one that shows up more clearly. But for me, it's like, yeah, you know, there's a pain in my body. It's like, I don't like that. I don't want that. I need to get rid of it. I need to fix it. I need to change it. All of that kind of obvious aversion to the experience. So the kind of obvious senses of dislike, of anger, of frustration, of hatred. Some more subtle forms of this might be, you know, it's a subtle sense of discontent. It's like, just not quite what I want it to be. You know, it's not really bad. It's not like it's a problem. But yeah, it's just, yeah, it's not really good. A little more subtle flavor of that aversion. Or boredom even can come out of a slight aversion to the experience. That there can be a sense of when something that we don't like, we can just kind of disconnect, check out from it, out of that aversion. One of the most kind of insidious or, you know, sneaky kinds of aversion attitudes is something along the lines, okay, you're paying attention to something that's unpleasant. Often the aversion will arise out of an unpleasant experience. So you're paying attention to something unpleasant. And the mind has this attitude of, by paying attention to this properly, this unpleasant experience will go away. And that's basically being mindful out of aversion. So that's a subtle form of aversion that's operating there. So helpful to get to know that attitude, that agenda is present. It may not be that agenda will go away, but at least you know it's operating. At least you know that filter is there. It's better to know it's there than to be kind of unconsciously motivated by it. Then delusion is a little bit more complex. And I don't have the time to go into delusion that I would like, because, you know, delusion is a very interesting state of mind. And, you know, greed and aversion can be pretty clear to us, but recognizing delusion is a little bit more mysterious. You know, it seems like, how do we recognize delusion? So there's three basic flavors of delusion that I'll just kind of briefly touch into. And the first one is a kind of a disconnection, a not connecting with a kind of a checked out state, a not knowing, an uncertainty, that kind of just not connecting with experience. Boredom can come into this place as well, because when there's a disconnection from experience, boredom can manifest. And so boredom can also be a manifestation of delusion. So that's one way that delusion manifests. So kind of that spaced out, disconnected, uncertain, confused state can be a manifestation of delusion. So if you're checking into your experience and what's your relationship to it, confused, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do about this. That's a manifestation of delusion. The second aspect of delusion is denial. Now, denial often has the flavor of denying something we don't want. You know, the classic elephant in the room scenario, that we deny something unpleasant is there. That's often what we think of when we think of the term denial. And that's motivated more by aversion, that kind of denial. But there is a kind of a more pure form of denial that is not connected to greed or aversion. And it may be, it comes from essentially having some view in our mind that is not a true view. So there's a mistakenness to this view, and we see things from that perspective. So this comes back to those filters that we see our experience through. So for instance, you know, there might be a view formed in your mind based on just being told something repeatedly. You know, not particularly about greed or aversion, but just because you're told repeatedly. You know, in this culture, we are told repeatedly, America's the land of opportunity. Anyone who works hard enough can live their dream. So, you know, that can lead to a belief or a view that if I'm not living my dream, I'm not working hard enough. Or if I'm not living my dream, there's something wrong with me. So it's not necessarily true that that anybody who works hard enough can live their dream in this country. But we can operate from that distorted view. So that's just one way. There's many ways these forms of delusion can create distorted perception. And that points to the third kind, which is basically the fundamental distortions of perception that the Buddha pointed to. He said, you know, we go around in our lives with the delusion that we think that things are permanent when they're impermanent. We think that things are reliable as a place for happiness when they're unreliable. And we think that things are self when what they actually are is not what we think of as self, but they're more of a process of just a flow of conditions. So he talks about these three basic forms of delusion. You may recognize those three. They're the three insights that this mindfulness practice is said to open us up to. This insight practice is said to open us to insight into impermanence. We actually recognize the impermanence of experience. We actually recognize the unreliableness, the sufferingness. I mean, the inherent unreliability is actually what that second one is talking about. That we think things are a place where we can be happy to get some satisfaction from, but because they're impermanent, they're kind of inherently unreliable. And then the third one, that we think things are self when they're not self. So this is the insight into not self. So essentially the insight in insight meditation undermines these delusions. So these filters are very hard to see. It's not necessarily that you would be able to, it's not that necessarily that we can be able to say, what's my attitude, and be able to see, oh yes, I'm seeing things as permanent when they're impermanent. You know, you're probably not going to check into your attitude and get that as a hit of what's happening in your mind. But what you can have happen over time is that in paying attention to your experience, you begin to see, bringing your mindfulness to your experience more continuously, at some point you'll see something happen in your experience. You'll see that something that you've been paying attention to vanishes, it ends. And you'll kind of recognize there can be a surprise to that when the insight of impermanence comes to us. I remember at one point I was in a meditation hall and there were people walking in the meditation hall and somebody vanished behind a pole. And it was as if they completely disappeared in my mind. It's like just something about the way my mind worked. Is like, and then she reappeared as she came from on the other side of the pole. It was just startling to me. It's like, oh, she wasn't there. Now she is. You know. So this recognition, the insight into impermanence begins to point out to us that the way we perceive things, usually, I mean, like, typically, you don't see somebody disappear like that. You remember that they're there, and, you know, it's almost like in your mind's eye, you're carrying them by that pole, so that you're not surprised when they come out the other side, you know. But this situation, my mind was just, you know, so present. It was like, oh, she's gone. Oh my God, she's gone. Oh, she's back. Wow. So it can be kind of a surprise when that happens, and that begins to point to the kind of way that our mind carries permanence or imputes permanence to things. You know, it's that's not a great example because, you know, she is there behind the pole, but. But you know, if you see something vanish like that, you know, you're watching something, a phenomenon of wanting, and you see that wanting vanish, you'll see that there had been a kind of an imputation of permanence to that experience. And the disappearance of it comes as a shock. It's like, oh, it's not permanent. And then we begin to see how those filters work. It's almost through the beginning to see through them with mindfulness, the beginning to have the insights, that we begin to see how those distortions of perception work in our minds. And we can begin in knowing that these work on all of our in all of our psyches. These three fundamental delusions are in all of our psyches. And we can just begin to, you know, undermine it a little bit by checking in. Well, okay, this thing seems to be permanent. How permanent is it? You know, so kind of checking in when things feel solid or stable. How solid and stable is it really? I'm just beginning to kind of explore that terrain. So I'll finish with just kind of suggesting a couple of useful times to check into the attitude. So as I said earlier, it's not so helpful to be continuous, you know, to do it kind of really frequently, but, you know, from time to time, every few minutes or so, every 10 minutes or so. But there's some particularly good times to check in. One of the best times to check in is if you feel a sense of struggle or conflict happening in your experience. If you're paying attention to something and it feels like it's hard to do that, check your attitude. There's some filter operating if there's a sense of struggle in your experience. So using suffering as our guide, you know, check in to this attitude when you notice some kind of suffering. Another good time to check in is when you remember about mindfulness. So your mind has been lost in thought and you come back, you remember, check your attitude. Sometimes the wandering off into thought can have impacted what's going on in your mind and have brought in a filter unbeknownst to you. So check your attitude when you come back from being lost in thought. You may have been lost in a thought, frustration about a particular situation, and you come back and that frustration attitude is there. So check in when you come back from being lost in thought. So last time, really helpful to check in. When it feels like it's going really well. Feel like, yep, I figured it out. Check your attitude. So it's 9 o'clock, so I need to stop. I didn't have quite enough time to cover everything that I'd hoped to cover, but I hope that this was helpful at least for you. So.